Anyone can make a difference. It doesn't matter how old or young you are. Find a problem, get some friends together, and go do it. Remember, you don't have to change the world. Just change your world. Says Joan Trumpower Mulholland. Join me, Brenda Starr, next on Through the Eyes of Women, when Joan shares how she stood for freedom as a young woman during the 60s civil rights movement. Welcome to Through the Eyes of Women, a program featuring the lives and perspectives of women, local, national, and international. She stood for freedom, the untold story of a civil rights hero, Joan Trumpower Mulholland, is a new book by Loki Mulholland and illustrated by Carlotta Jansen. I am joined today by Joan Trumpower Mulholland. It is a great honor to have you on the phone today, Joan, and welcome to Through the Eyes of Women.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to be asked.
Well, I think I want to start with, tell us a little bit about your very, very early life.
Well, I grew up in Arlington, Virginia, which was definitely the South. I mean, Robert E. Lee is my homeboy. But the apartments my parents moved into when I was an infant were predominantly Jewish because nobody else would rent to Jews back then. And so about 90% of my playmates were from liberal New York Jewish families. And I think just through osmosis, I absorbed a lot of outlooks. My mother's family was from the deep rural south of Georgia. My father's family was from southwest Iowa. So he was not a segregationist, but back then women ruled the roost. And I grew up in this mixed marriage, as we might say. And I went to Sunday school regularly and memorized all these Bible verses, basically how to treat people, love thy neighbor as thyself, that type of things. And I could clearly see by the time I was, you know, 9 or 10, that we weren't practicing what we preached. And I thought this was wrong. So that led me ultimately to the civil rights movement.
Now, you talk about mixed marriage, which I'm sure is a metaphor from having a Southern mother and a Northern dad. But you're a white Southerner.
Yes, very definitely white Southerner, and proud of it.
And very proud of it. And so growing up in Virginia in the 50s, you mentioned the things that you saw. How did your parents react to your observations when you were
actually
younger?
Actually, I was growing up in Virginia in the 40s.
Oh, that's right.
In the 50s, I was in junior high and high school, still growing up, but that never ends. I pretty much kept my mouth shut back then because I knew what Mama thought. And but by the time I got into the civil rights movement, my mother was horrified. This was 1960. And, you know, what would the neighbors think? How could she tell the family, type of thing? My father, on the other hand, supported the goals, but as a good government bureaucrat, thought you should change the law at the top and not have this nonviolent guerrilla warfare, one lunch counter here and one lunch counter there, but change the law at the top. And, of course, Brown versus Board had proved that doesn't work, quickly anyway, and but I think he was mainly afraid I'd get killed.
Right. So your sensibilities in junior high school then took an advocacy approach to your sensibilities?
I didn't really get into advocacy until college. Now, when I was in high school, there was very secretive meetings at my church. This would have been around 58, and court orders were looming in Arlington, which did become the first county to have an integrated school in the state of Virginia. But we had to keep it all very quiet. Secret meetings with some of the black students and our regular Sunday evening youth group, spaghetti dinner type thing. Secretive because we were violating the state public assembly law and the police could arrest us. The American Nazi Party headquarters were literally around the corner. The Klan was still around. And, of course, some of the church elders could lock us out of the church. So we kept it quiet. The black students and the white students broke bread together and sort of got to know each other. So I guess when the schools didn't integrate, some of us would know each other. But this was kept so secretive that 50 years later, celebrating the integration of the schools, I raised the question at a big gathering in the county. In fact, at two big gatherings. Could anybody tell me anything about this? Was it just our church? Was it happening all over the county? Who started it? The white ministers? The black ministers? How did this happen? Nobody knew. Or if they knew, they weren't telling, still 50 years later. So this was sort of the beginning. But I had really had my eyes opened, and this is sort of going backwards. When I was about 10 and down visiting Grandma, which we did every summer in Oconee, Georgia, which not the resort Oconee, the lumber town. And my every summer playmate Mary and I snuck off and went into the area which is politely called the quarters. That wasn't what we called it. I mean, the whites were dirt poor. They'd just gotten running water a year or two before. But in the black area, it was so much worse. And then I saw the black school, just a tumble-down shack. Never had any paint on it. No glass in the windows, just wood shutters. Pot-bellied stove, the door was ajar. One outhouse. One, I guess it was a pump. I don't remember if it was a pump or a well. But it was so pitiful. And then the white kids in the community could go to this brand new post-World War II brick school that was the pride of the county. And just this complete discrepancy is what I think really led me to the decision that when I got the chance to try to change things, I had to do it to make the South the best that it could be for all of its people.
So the injustices that you saw were formulated even preteen with these relationships that you had with people that you knew was clandestine. How did that make you feel going to school?
Well, now, the clandestine trip when I was 10 back in to the quarters, and then when I was in high school, the meetings at the church. At school, I went to Annandale High School in Virginia, and of course it was segregated, but with the court orders looming, there were some of us who were just meeting informally and talking, and our big concern was the schools stay open. Virginia was closing schools. The girl who sat next to me in 11th grade Spanish class was a year behind. She was not having her senior year because where she lived elsewhere in Virginia, remember this is an all-white school, where she had been living, the schools were closed. And I think she had been sent to live with relatives or friends where there were schools. That was our fear, that we would not have a school. Just, weren't concerned about who came to it. Just keep it open, and if the court orders integration, integrate it. Don't close it. But these were not big, you know, forums in the school. These were little, small group conversations.
Because this was at a time when there was nobody from outside of your community that brought you together to tell you these things. These are just your observations from growing up.
Northern Virginia was a very transient area. A lot of folks had moved in with the Depression. There was a lot of military presence in and out. So there was an outside influence. This was not a sort of a closed community, but it was still Virginia, and you didn't rock the boat.
Because there were laws in place.
There were laws, and folks say, oh, Northern Virginia isn't the South. Well, it's Virginia, and the state law is the state law.
It is below the Mason-Dixon line, right?
Definitely. We got Maryland, which was also segregated north of us.
Right. People forget that Maryland is also below the Mason-Dixon line.
And there is still an active Klan up around Thurmont, Maryland. That's the last stop before Camp David, where the president is right now.
Hmm. Interesting.
But you don't see that in the newspapers much.
No, you don't. Well, but I guess if you live there, you do. But the rest of us don't, unless we're talking about what we think of as ancient history. But it's really not. It's so much
closer. No, it's a current event.
It's a current event. It is a current event. Now, when you were going to school, as you were going to college, you also were very instrumental in changing laws. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, I ended up at Duke University because my mother wanted me to go to a name school in the South rather than this small church college in Ohio that I wanted to go to. Something safely segregated, she wanted. And the sit-in started the spring semester of my freshman year. And again, our Presbyterian chaplain told us there was going to be some students from North Carolina College who were holding sit-ins. Durham was the second city after Greensboro to start sit-ins. And anyway, they were going to come and explain to us about the sit-ins, but keep it quiet. My son actually has an error in one of the two books with a poster saying that was what got me into it. Mistake that came later. That can get edited out. But it was like being back in high school. We'll have a meeting. Some black students will come and talk with us. Keep it quiet. The administration could lock us out. The police could show up and arrest us. And local rowdies could come up and start violence. I mean, deja vu all the way. So these well-spoken, well-dressed students from North Carolina College came and explained to us morally and legally about the sit-ins, and then, lo and behold, invited us to join them on the picket lines. And a handful of us did, and that led to us getting arrested. And the Duke administration just sort of going ballistic. Apparently we would have been expelled except the university professors acted to keep us in the school. But I didn't need this aggravation. Finished my semester and dropped out. And that led to my going to Tougaloo College in Mississippi.
What was your internal makeup at that time that possessed you to be such a devoted, not only a fighter for the cause of equal justice, but to know what you might be coming up against? How did you internalize that at the time?
Well, once you got involved, there was no turning back. And the movement became family. And I believed that what I was doing was in keeping with my religious faith and the Declaration of Independence, albeit that was written by a slave owner, but that's a whole other issue. But it's just, you got to do the right thing.
You got to do the right thing. This is Brenda Starr, and you're listening to Through the Eyes of Women. My guest today is Joan Trumphauer Mulholland, who is highlighted in the book entitled She Stood for Freedom, The Untold Story of a Civil Rights Hero, and that would be Joan Trumphauer Mulholland. Now, let's talk about this book that was written by or compiled by your son, Loki. Tell us about him.
Well, I think he is one of the byproducts of my involvement in the civil rights movement. My sons grew up in a very different world than I did, though less than a mile from where I grew up in Arlington. The schools were basically no majority, except one semester his school was 52% Southeast Asian, but that was, of course, divided three ways. And so they knew, or they absorbed from having me as their mom, that you see people as people. So he grew up with this mentality and actually got roughed up a few times for protecting Vietnamese kids who were his friends. He's a filmmaker. He made a film on the civil rights movement, again, telling my story. The lesson to any young folks hearing this is never forget how to manipulate your parents. It's a life skill, just like tying your shoes was. He tricked me into this movie, though I have forgiven him. It was supposed to bring together a bunch of folks you haven't heard of in the civil rights movement, and I thought, oh, the March on Washington, and gave him, and I'm talking over my rotary phone, mind you, this is old school, with a paper address book, giving him contact information for my buddies, and he did contact some of them and have them in the movie, but I am the connecting thread in the movie, An Ordinary Hero. And from that, without a by your leave from Mama, he went on feeling that education was important, that kids today know what came before and maybe they can utilize it. He came out with these two children's books, one that's basically a picture book, more limited text, but it's all telling the same story. And the limited text one is for the lower elementary, and then for the upper elementary, more detailed text, but a lot of copies of primary sources. So that introduces the concept of primary sources and utilizing those. And he's got a foundation that all the profits will go to from these books to use for educational purposes, using the books and the movie as part of a curriculum. And he works in film with his day job in social studies, so I think he turned out okay.
He is his mother's son. And it's the Joan Trumpower Mulholland Foundation that he started, is that correct?
That's correct. Didn't ask me about that either, but, you know, I didn't ask my mother about a lot of things, nor did any of us.
He's carrying on your tradition, Joan, that's for sure. Now, the book is just beautiful. It's illustrated, and it's very colorful. It really draws you in. So I can see where he had said it was for ages 7 and up, and you can be drawn in by the pictures. It's very beautifully done. Like I said, it's illustrated by Carlotta Jansen, and what a wonderful job she did. It also is filled with lots of pieces of your memorabilia. Let's just talk about the fact that Standing for Freedom is going to be directly talking about the sit-ins, the Freedom Rides, the March on Washington, the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing, the Freedom Summer, and the Selma to Montgomery March. The pictures, the artwork, like I said, the memorabilia, there's receipts and programs and notes, the poster that you talked about. And then at the end, there is a timeline. There's a timeline of which I think that you had mentioned it's a place for children to go to find out more about something. And I find that it is very relevant today. You don't have to go on Google. You can read a book. Real paper. And
I've had plenty of kids ask me if Dr. King knew Abraham Lincoln.
Wow.
You know, they have no real sense of this when things happen. Everything is so immediate now that you don't have a context. And if you don't know where you came from, you don't know where you're going, and you're subject to repeat
right. The
mistakes of the past. I mean, we've heard calls for internment camps. Do we remember the 40s?
Right. Well, we have a very short memory in this country, and some of it might have to do with the fact that you can constantly look up information and move forward.
Yeah, you don't have to remember it. You just Google it.
Right, you just Google it. That's why this book is so important. It really feels your life. It shows your life. And one of the most iconic photographs in my memory was students sitting at the Woolworths counter in Mississippi. And
that was the day.
And that was the day. And you were in that photo, Joan.
Like having a famous photo focused on the back of your head. But now the story on that is Fred Blackwell, the photographer. He was the second string photographer for the evening paper. He came in after the first string guy had gone back to get his film developed, another, you know, ancient thing. But he knew a lot of the guys in the mob behind us. He went to the same high school that they did. He had gone. He knew their older brothers and sisters. One of the guys lived down the three doors down the street from him. He was 22, just like the folks at the counter. And understandably, his sympathies were with his buddies. But he ended up standing on the lunch counter. It wasn't just us. There was another group about 10 seats down the counter that we couldn't even see through the mob. He could point the camera at us. He could pivot and point it the other way. He was in a very dangerous position, and he knew it. One of his buddies could just think, "You traitor," and grab his leg. That would have been it. The TV cameraman that day had already been knocked to the floor and have his camera smashed. To me, the press was in every bit as much danger as the demonstrators. They were the heroes because they took the message to the world. But Fred, young man, stood on that counter for 3 hours taking pictures. And by the time it was over, his sympathies had shifted from his friends to the nonviolent demonstrators at the counter. And that's the power of nonviolence. And that is, for me, the crucial part of that picture.
Now, what I always wanted to know is, what was in your right hand?
Sometimes I think it's a New Testament, but at this point, I think it is a little change purse.
Is that what you had to buy, and the receipt is in the book? Is that what you had to buy in order to sit at the lunch counter?
No, I don't even think I bought anything because I wasn't planning to sit down. But I was what they called a spotter. There was what we thought would be a diversionary picket line down the street at another store. And as a white person, I could just sort of blend into, the people walking down the street. But I had, back in the day of payphones, I had dimes in my change purse to call Medgar Evers' office and let him know what was happening. That was my role that day. Well, the picket line was arrested real quick. We hadn't expected that. So the other white lady from Tougaloo and I phoned in to Medgar's office and reported they'd been taken off in the paddy wagon. And then it was, well, we haven't seen any police cars or paddy wagons going down to Woolworth. Let's go down and see what's happening. Well, what was happening is all sorts of violence was breaking loose. And ultimately, Lois and I ended up sitting at the lunch counter with the two separate groups. And then it turned into a 3-hour survival siege. And more people came to join us, including the white guy. Well, he's really Native American, but looks white. It's sitting next to me.
Especially with all that sugar and salt poured over him.
Yeah, and some of that is blood with ketchup because he was attacked with brass knuckles. Cigarettes were put out in the back of his neck. You can still see the scars. They mixed water and black pepper and threw it in his eyes. And it was just sit there and take it.
The power of nonviolence.
Well, Gandhi taught us.
Yes, and we're still trying to utilize that today.
Yeah.
Where do we go today with the history that you've just shared with the people that you met, Joan? If we can just run down a list, and a lot of people will be aghast. It's like, wow, she knew Martin Luther King. She knew Stokely Carmichael. She knew you were part of so much because there was so much energy at the time.
Now, King I just knew in passing, but Stokely was my buddy. We got arrested on the Freedom Ride together, and to the end, we were friends when we ran into each other.
And you also, in the book, your dedication is, above all else, remember Medgar. Can you tell us about Mr. Medgar Wiley Evers?
Medgar was a native of Mississippi, a World War II vet. And when he came back from fighting for freedom in Europe, he started really fighting for freedom in Mississippi. Couldn't hold a job because of it. Eventually, the NAACP took him on as a field secretary for the state. But he wasn't an outsider coming in. He was a native. And he did it all. If you ever had any legal needs, you could contact him. He'd contact the lawyers. He was all over the place, organizing youth groups, working on voter registration, getting investigations going at the level he could. And the friendliest person. A reporter asked me, "What do you remember about Medgar?" This was at the 50th anniversary of the Woolworth sit-in, and they were putting up a historical plaque, and I was speaking, running my mouth. And I just told the reporter his smile. That was not the answer the reporter wanted, but that was it. My main memory of Medgar. Yes, he was courageous. Yes, he did it all. But my main memory was that smile of his. So warm, so welcoming, so reassuring.
Yes, I think the main message of you, Joan Trumpower Mulholland, is your heart. You wrote a poem called Dialogue. Could you recite that for us?
No, I don't have it in front of me, but you can read it.
I will. Thank you very much. Where have you been? To jail. What did you do? Nothing. Nothing but act like an American. Why did you do that? I thought you were a Southerner. I am. Yes. Then why? That's why. Because I'm a Southerner. Nothing more? I'm a Christian. That's what they all say, but for a different reason. I read the Declaration of Independence. You are strange. Yes, very strange. Very strange, but not alone. Very powerful, and it really sums up who you are as a person, Joan.
When I spoke at the dedication of the historic plaque at the 50th anniversary of the Woolworth sit-in, I mentioned the people at the counter. I mentioned all the members of the press, several of whom were present. In closing, I said, remember the people at the counter, remember the press, but above all, remember Medgar Evers. And for his daughter, I wanted to put that in for my remark, dedication, what have you.
Yes. Well, his daughter and your son, you know, what a legacy.
And they're carrying it forward.
And they are.
And hopefully some of the students who read the book, or teachers read it to them, will get an idea that they can put together with the ways things are done now, and they can carry it forward.
And the name of that book is She Stood for Freedom, The Untold Story of a Civil Rights Hero, Joan Trumpower Mulholland. And Joan, once again, thank you so very much. Much success with the book and Loki and the movie. I'm sure people will be revisiting that again as well. Thank you for joining us from Virginia. We wish you very well.
Thank you, and stay away from forest fires and stay cool.
Thank you so much. Blessings to you.
Blessings.
Oh, thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now. You've been listening to Through the Eyes of Women. I've been your host, Brenda Starr, and I've been speaking with Joan Trumpower Mulholland. And we've been discussing a new book about her entitled She Stood for Freedom, The Untold Story of a Civil Rights Hero, Joan Trumpower Mulholland, by Loki Mulholland. For more information about the new book, visit anordinaryhero.com. Through the Eyes of Women is produced for KHSU, located at Humboldt State University. Thanks to today's engineer, Katie Whiteside, and to the entire Through the Eyes of Women team. To listen to this program again, visit our blog at khsuwomen.com, where you can also learn more about the show and post listener comments. Join us again next Monday at 1:30, right here on KHSU.